It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Republican-controlled state legislature is appealing a Dane County judge's decision this week to overturn parts of Act 10.
As of right now, the court's decision restores many collective bargaining rights for most public sector unions. Act 10 had eliminated that possibility for most public unions, except for police and firefighters.
Litigation over the court decision is likely to reach the state Supreme Court before this is over. And to note, Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of UW-Madison and the Educational Communications Board, a state agency.
On Wednesday, we got a reaction from John Shelton, member of the American Federation of Teachers Wisconsin and professor at UW-Green Bay. Now we hear from Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the legal arguments before we get into the policy implications. Rick, the argument here in this case was an equal protection case saying, hey, this law treated one group of public employees or some groups of public employees different than others. The judge, at least this judge, agreed with that argument. What do you make the legal back and forth there?
Well, it's an extraordinary decision. So, you know, the Wisconsin Constitution does have an equal protection guarantee that's implied from some more general language. But if you look at the way that courts have generally handled equal protection claims, as long as they don't involve the exercise of a fundamental right or a classification based on what's called a suspect category, like, you know, race or sex, courts are very deferential, right? The equal protection guarantee does not mean that all groups of people must be treated equally. And if you think about it for a moment, it's got to be that way because the law makes distinctions between people all the time based upon their circumstance. So what happens is there's two ways that this is formulated in Wisconsin, but typically courts afford what's called rational basis review. And what rational basis review tends to mean, in fact, as long as you can conceive of a potential rationale for some government interest, even if the classification is not perfect, even if they haven't included everybody that might be included in the classification, the government distinction stands. And the reason for that is under our system, the legislature makes the law, and we don't want courts to actively be second-guessing what the legislature has done, which is often, you know, a product of politics and compromise.
And so that distinction, as you just said, in this case, I think the argument was we're saying there's a category that is public safety workers, police, firefighters, some others, and a category that isn't that. So in this appeal, I assume this argument is going to be made. So that is a reasonable distinction of category?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that I don't think that the court, if I'm reading court's opinion correctly, I don't think that the court concluded that you couldn't distinguish between public safety workers and non-public safety workers. He just thought that there were some people, basically Capitol and university police, that ought to be included in the public safety category. And if you look at the way both federal and state courts have tended to handle this issue in the past, and of course, in the law, nothing is perfect. You can always find a counterexample. The courts have not required that degree of perfection. So if you look at this situation, what happened is the legislature took some of the categories of a larger grouping called protective occupation employees, and it picked the ones that it thought were most important to exclude from Act 10 because they were concerned about what the impact would be of an unauthorized labor action. And they thought that when it comes to, you know, these public safety workers, they simply couldn't risk that. And so to say that, well, that classification becomes illegal because they didn't include every conceivable public safety officer, including university and Capitol Police, I think is inconsistent, fundamentally inconsistent with the way courts have tended to deal with these classifications because they don't require that the classifications be perfect. They do allow some degree of what we call over-inclusiveness or under-inclusiveness. And so this was an extraordinary judicial intrusion into a judgment that was made by the legislature. And it's one that was rejected by federal judge Bill Conley back when Act 10 first came on the books in 2011. Judge Conley said, look, I don't like Act 10. I don't like the way that the Walker administration went about doing this. But I can't say, given the law that I'm bound to follow, which is basically the same as what the Wisconsin courts do, I can't say that this is unconstitutional.
Now, I'm going to stay with the law a bit here. It's interesting because potentially a judge could say, yeah, I don't like that Capitol Police, University Police are left out. But unlike Judge Frost, they could say the cure for that is put them in. Right. They could have a less broad rejection of Act 10 than the judge made here, but still be sympathetic to the plaintiff's argument.
Right. And that's an argument that we made in an amicus brief. And actually, I'd also made that argument back in 2011. And the idea here is, OK, if you don't like this classification, then what do you do? And clearly, the legislature expressed a policy judgment about collective bargaining in the public sector. And another way of dealing with this is to say, well, all right, if we don't like this classification, if, for example, to go back to real examples of, equal protection problems back in the past, if we don't like the fact that, say, a particular racial group was excluded from a government program, the answer is not to eliminate the government program and eliminate the amendment of the law, but it's to include the excluded group. And so here I think, if you don't start with the bias that, collective bargaining is good, the outcome that you might reach is to say, look, this exclusion of, public safety workers is not permitted. And so we're going to include them in the general scheme of Act 10.
Talking to Rick Essenberg, Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty president, looking at a judge overturning Act 10 this week, the collective bargaining law affecting public employees, most public employees, and an appeal, of course, in the works. Turning to the policy side of things, Rick, earlier this year, your organization said, hey, if we eliminate Act 10, it could cost local taxpayers roughly an additional $480 million a year. I mentioned we talked to John Shelton earlier this week with the American Federation of Teachers of Wisconsin, happy about this court ruling. Here's what he had to say to that.
Collective bargaining is a tool, and having that tool to be able to have, a stronger seat at the table with district administration is only going to help students in the long run. And teacher unions are going to, I can promise you that our unions in AFT Wisconsin are going to work with the school districts to try and make sure that students get everything that they need. And so that's what this is really about. And any efforts to try and say that K-12 teacher unions are going to like bankrupt school districts is just disingenuous.
Rick, your reaction, your thoughts on the financial impact here, if this holds.
I think if you get behind what he's really saying there, there's no inconsistency. He didn't refute what we found. And if you could look back at Act 10, at the time that Act 10 was passed, there was a real problem. The state was facing a very, very serious revenue shortfall because it had been relying on federal funds that were provided to states and localities in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008. And that money was gone now. And so what are you going to do? Well, the one thing you could do is you could raise taxes very, very high. Another thing you could do is you could cut services very, very deep. Or you could take a look at the cost of providing those services. And that's what Act 10 did. And to say that collective bargaining is a tool by which public employee unions provide greater services is, I think, ignoring the purpose of collective bargaining. I mean, collective bargaining is a tool that is used to change the supply and demand curves. It is designed to create a stronger bargaining position for represented employees in the hopes that they will be able to win a higher compensation package from the employer. Now, we can argue about whether that's good or whether that's bad, whether that's fair, whether that's not. But the whole purpose of collective bargaining is to shift the allocation of public resources to public employees. And so to deny that that's the case and to deny that this isn't going to cost taxpayers' money goes against the very theory of collective bargaining. And so we took a look at the impact. Yeah, it's $438 million for local units of government. It's another billion for school districts. And that's every year. And so, before you celebrate this opinion, you ought to at least acknowledge the fact that in all likelihood, this is going to substantially increase the cost of providing the same level of government services.
In our last minute or so, this is likely, as so many things do, to end up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Justice Protasiewicz, seen as one of the liberal justices in her campaign, mentioned, hey, I protested against Act 10. I might consider recusing myself. Justice Hagedorn, seen on the conservative side, well, he was part of Governor Walker's legal team when this thing was crafted. There have been some speculation that he should recuse himself. Your thoughts on recusal for either, both, or neither?
Well, I mean, typically prejudging a case is grounds for recusal. And, you know, candidate Protasiewicz said she thought that this was unconstitutional. I don't think it's going to create a due process problem if she doesn't recuse, but we'll see. Typically a judge would recuse. Oftentimes it's also a basis of recusal if a judge was involved in something that, and, you know, leads to the very case that was before the court. And there could be a strong argument there for Justice Hagedorn to recuse as well, although perhaps that's been attenuated by the passage of time over the years. And also for both of them, what's called the rule of necessity. And the point there is the Wisconsin Supreme Court is a collegial court, a last resort, right? Everybody that's on that court has been elected to decide these important issues. And you can make an argument that recusal is a much more serious thing for Supreme Court justices than it.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, looking at the latest on the court process for Act 10 in Wisconsin.
Coming up, a National Pediatricians Group updates its recommendations for reading to babies now starting at birth.
Reading, especially with young children, should not necessarily be a solitary activity. It's fundamentally a relationship-based activity.
The latest on childhood literacy, that's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For the first time in a decade, the American Academy of Pediatrics is out with a new literacy promotion policy statement with updated recommendations on how pediatricians and caregivers can encourage early childhood literacy starting at birth.
The statement also highlights the work of Reach Out and Read. That's a national organization which helps incorporate the importance of reading to children as part of their checkups.
Our next guest is a Wisconsin pediatrician who's a contributing writer for the new literacy promotion policy by the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is a professor of pediatrics and human development and family studies at UW-Madison. He is founding medical director of Reach Out and Read Wisconsin and the current chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Early Childhood. Dr. Navsaria, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
You helped write this new literacy promotion policy for the American Academy of Pediatrics, first update in 10 years. You know, this statement really hones in on this term shared reading. Can you explain for us what is shared reading?
Yeah, so this is a way of just expressing good old sitting down and reading with your child or a child in your life in whatever way, shape, or form. It highlights that reading, especially with young children, should not necessarily be a solitary activity. Like, let's not just push books at children and say, hey, just go look at books, kid, figure it out on your own. That it's fundamentally a relationship-based activity, that it's something that should be shared between a parent and a child, or again, with any loving adult in their life.
And what I really loved about reading with my kids, still read to them, it's not past tense here, but, it, you know, I could be animated and, you know, use inflection, and I could really catch their little ears with, like, the range in my voice and with question marks and characters. Does that passion rub off?
I think it definitely does. And actually, you've hit the nail on the head, because for folks like you or I who have been around people who read to young children, we naturally automatically absorb a lot of these things about making different voices or asking the child questions about what they can find on the page and doing this back and forth. This is the fancy term for this is something called dialogic reading. But, you know, if you've not been exposed to this, you may think that a young child is supposed to sit quietly and just be read to, and whatever's on the page is exactly what you do. And I think you and I both know that that doesn't work so well with a short, naturally short attention span, squirmy 15-month-old, for example.
How influential can pediatricians be in promoting this type of engagement, this reading, when, you know, that little baby is sitting in your office?
Very much. So the Reach Out and Read program, which I've worked with for many years, it's a program that's been around for 35 years, provides training and technical assistance to healthcare providers in implementing advice and guidance about shared reading as part of those regular checkups that we're all familiar with, 14 visits starting at birth all the way up through age five. We know that pediatricians and our colleagues in family medicine, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, anyone who's doing primary care for children, we work with them to train, hone, help them ask gently and supportively as part of that checkup about shared reading, reinforce what families are already doing well, telling them, yep, you got it, keep doing more of that, please, or to spend time with them saying, wow, you know, you said you feel like your child doesn't like reading. Can we talk about that some more? What are you noticing? What are you seeing? And offering some troubleshooting so that shared reading becomes a daily part of every child's life, every single day, ideally.
The new recommendations include reading to children starting at birth, even perhaps in the neonatal intensive care unit, rather than waiting until they're a 6-month-old. What can you tell us about what infants may be absorbing in these interactions so early on?
Yeah, this is something that surprises people, because they say, what can a child learn at that point in time? The old report, the old statement said, start at 6 months. And we've now backed that all the way back to birth, because there's so much evidence, not just about the things that have to do with reading, right? How do you turn pages in a book, and how do you learn to eventually recognize letters and words and sentences and things like that? But there's a whole other thing that, honestly, Reach Out and Read has been doing all along, but we didn't have the language for it yet, is something we call relational health. This is a field of study that's been exploding in so many areas. This is the study of relationships and how strong and supportive and mutually reinforcing they are. And when you do good shared reading all the way from the early days of life, you're also contributing not just to early literacy, but to early relational health, which is just as important. So when a child is in your lap and they're hearing your voice, they're hearing the cadence of sentences, when they're hearing the love, they're feeling your touch, you're doing something together, all of these play into that child and really feed their development in ways that absolutely nothing can. We need to remember there is no toy. There is no video, there is no app that will drive development forward on its own. It's nurturing, caring, responsive interactions with others. So we're hoping that we can help build some of those through regular shared reading experiences.
The reality may be that we have devices in our hands seemingly all the time, you know, checking the phone, checking an app, and that has to be set down in these times. I'm wondering, you know, the new recommendations expressly say that the print books are better than digital books for young children. Can you go into that? Why is that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I'll just start off by saying, yes, as I once heard someone say, and I think it's apt, there is no app to replace your lap. So let's keep that in mind.
Oh, I love it. That should be a bumper sticker.
Indeed. So, print books, we find that the turning of paper pages, the fact that there's not other distractions in a paper book that can exist on electronic devices, make them a better choice to do paper books rather than ebooks. Now, I want to be really clear about something. If a family says to me, hey, look, we're out and about with young kids the whole day, and if we have some downtime, we're pulling out an iPad and we're looking at, you know, one of the 40 picture books that I have loaded on that iPad. I'm not lugging around a pile of 40 books. The iPad is much lighter and easy to carry. Of course, that's absolutely fine. But if you have a choice, I would say yes, go for the traditional paper books rather than ebooks, just because the evidence is pretty strong that we should be actually focusing on the paper books.
What do you think about repetition? What is the impact of reading the same book over and over and over to that young kiddo?
So when a child asks for that same book over and over, and yes, I have a memory of reading, I think, Sandra Boynton's Dinosaurs Binket to my son something like 30 times on a flight to Hawaii when he was little.
Oh, it wasn't Pat the Bunny?
No. No, it was not. But that child is telling you a couple of things. One, they love the book, something about it. And with a young child, you know, we don't always know as adults why a particular book appeals to a particular child. We do know that the more beautifully written, the more amazingly illustrated, the more narrative depth and complexity that there is there, the greater the chance that it will connect with a child on some level. So we need to keep that in mind, but who knows sometimes. But number two, they're saying, I love it when you read this book aloud with me and share it with me. And I want to do that. It's not just about the book. It's also about you and expressing again, that relational health there, which I think is so key. I want to point something out though, that you know, we can all sit here and say, oh, yes, isn't that lovely, right? That kids love being read to and they ask for the same book over and over and over. And we all smile and kind of, you know, treasure that memory. I once had a parent who asked me after we were discussing shared reading for a little bit in a checkup, he said, Doctor, can I ask you, is my son's brain normal? And I said, well, yeah, as far as I can tell, everything looks fine. I have no concerns. Why do you ask that? And he said, well, he keeps asking for the book to be read over and over, and I'm wondering if he has a memory problem and that he's not remembering it. Hmm. Right. So this thing that we treasure had deeply worried him. Hmm. And I'm so happy that he had the trust to bring up this fear and that we could address it right then and there. So we sometimes need to remember these treasured moments aren't necessarily read the same way by everyone.
We're talking with Dr. Dipesh Navsaria, professor of pediatrics and human development and family studies at UW-Madison. He helped write the new early childhood literacy promotion policy for the American Academy of Pediatrics. First update in 10 years. Dr. Navsaria, the policy presents evidence that children's literacy skills at school entry and in kindergarten and first grade often predict their later reading success, and that poor reading skills in adulthood are associated with poor economic potential. How do you find literacy to be a determinant of economic outcomes?
Oh, gosh, it's so significant. The universe of meaningful careers available to people who can't read is shrinking every year that goes by. Even jobs that were once amenable to folks who may have poor literacy have changed. I mean, look at cars, right? They're basically rolling computers today. They're no longer these purely mechanical entities and so on. So when we don't build good literacy skills early on, we're actually affecting someone's entire life course.
Hmm. What do you want policy leaders, policy recommendations to come out from this report? Because there can be actions at the state level, there can be actions nationally. What is some guidance there?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things. One is to recognize that when we talk about building literacy in children, it's not simply about the classroom. So there's been lots of discussion and conversation and news and legislation about reading instruction. And that's fine and that's important. And I'm glad that we're talking about that. But I also need policymakers to recognize that before reading instruction even starts, there's a whole 5 years plus of a child's life in which comfort with books and shared reading and experiences also matter. So an extremely cost-effective evidence-based program like Reach Out and Read can help, because many children aren't necessarily in settings like early childhood education in preschools and so on, but they are coming in for checkups. And that's why we take that opportunity in healthcare to have these conversations. We are grateful that we do get some state funding and have in the last two state budgets. And here's fingers crossed for the next one. We'd love to see federal funding for Reach Out and Read. There was once upon a time, and we'd love to see that return. To recognize that this is a very low cost, very effective intervention. We don't actually pay doctors to do this work. We're actually throwing them in for free. All the dollars for Reach Out and Read really go to training, technical assistance, and to buying the books that make a difference. But without that training and technical assistance, we're simply a book giveaway program on its own. And the reality is that Reach Out and Read is actually secretly a parenting support program.
What type of training is most beneficial to encouraging these new parents and caregivers to read? Because what if a parent has low literacy skills and perhaps is feeling doubt in themselves and not feeling that confidence in reading?
Oh, you hit it right on the head there, because people often think that the problem is an information gap, that if we just told parents to do, you know, X, Y, or Z, then that's all, right? And the fact is that many parents have already heard that. They've heard about read, talk, sing, play with your young child. There's a skills gap. How do I read to my squirmy, you know, toddler who doesn't pay attention? And how do I engage them with that thing we talked about earlier called dialogic reading? And then also the confidence gap, right? There's parents sometimes with lower educational attainment who think, you know, I'm the wrong person to be teaching my child. You know, I didn't do so well in school myself. I'm going to mess them up. Maybe this learning DVD is better for them. And of course it isn't. But so the training we do with families is to ask about shared reading, reinforce what they're doing right. When they mention that, oh, my child doesn't seem to enjoy reading, you know, take out the book we just gave them and ask them to read a few pages and offer some quick tips, do some modeling, some coaching. We can do this very effectively in as little as just 3 minutes, and also do a lot of assessment of the child's development and other things about their life, which we should be doing as part of that checkup anyway. So there's many things we're able to incorporate in there.
How important is it when it comes to representing diverse cultures in books and the child, you know, seeing themselves in that character or looking like a character in the book? What effect does that have on that young mind?
Yeah, this is important because there's a concept out there called mirrors and windows that has been talked about in different places. One, children should see themselves reflected, but they should also see see other people's lives reflected in different ways, experiences that they just might not otherwise have in their daily lives. It can be about, you know, global cultures. It can be about, you know, rural and urban. It can be about different types of experiences, different makeups of families, different types of jobs that people have, right? This diversity comes in all sorts of forms. So it's a important thing to make sure that we're thinking about that and offering both representation as well as respectful and reasonable depictions of other people's worlds and lives.
There's a lot for a pediatrician to juggle in these visits, so many things that they're trying to watch out for and to look at and make sure everything is up to date. How receptive are pediatricians to this added layer of trying to engage with the family on a really important thing? Because there is a lot on the plate of that pediatrician.
There is, but the thing is that we've found that they really, really want to do this. When we talk to clinicians about Reach Out and Read, they say, yes, this gets at what my families need. There's sometimes some worries about, well, will I really have the time to do this? But once they've been through our training, and once we've, if we offer some technical assistance and guidance around how to incorporate this, they realize this. When I do talks to trainees, we play a sample, a recording of a Reach Out and Read visit, and then we talk through all the things we learn about the child's development, about family structure, about what they do together, about relational health, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I point out, after we've made this long list of all the things we've learned that we're supposed to be doing anyway, I point out that that entire video lasted 3 minutes. Mm. It's a really good use of 3 minutes. And it occurs when the clinician walks in with the book in their hand, gives it directly to that child, and watches what happens, watches their response, watches, do they toddle over to their parent and hold it out in that read to me gesture? Do they start turning pages? Do they start saying words? You learn so much in those few moments by doing skillful and intentional observation that honestly, I learn more from that book in most checkups than I do from my stethoscope.
Dr. Nefsaria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Dipesh Nefsaria is a professor of pediatrics and human development and family studies at UW-Madison. He hosts the national Reach Out and Read podcast, and he contributed to the new literacy promotion policy statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics that encourages parents and caregivers to read aloud with their newborns and young children. The policy statement is published in the new issue of the journal Pediatrics.
Coming up, a new documentary shares the early days of punk rock in Green Bay and the community that brought together bands and their fans.
They were sort of misfits, didn't quite fit in, and just found this like collective spirit.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Wisconsin business owner trying to revitalize history.
Madison's Greenbush neighborhood has a rich history that many people have forgotten. But as Maria Brunetta tells us, business owner and longtime Madisonian Sam Brown is working to preserve the legacy of the historic neighborhood.
Decades ago, the Greenbush neighborhood in Madison was an ethnically diverse neighborhood, home to African Americans plus Jewish and Italian immigrants. Then, in the 1960s, the city kicked out most of the residents for an urban renewal project.
Those families experienced a horrible trauma in being uprooted from their homes.
That's Sam Brown, who owns businesses on Greenbush's Regent Street.
The whole neighborhood bulldozed. Churches and synagogues torn down, grocery stores torn down, restaurants torn down. It was a very vibrant neighborhood, and they were poorly compensated for their property.
Nowadays, Regent Street is home to beloved local businesses and student housing. It's also a prime destination for UW football tailgate parties. But the street still holds a lot of historical significance that's not always known to newcomers. Brown is a longtime Madisonian who has long aspired to bring back the area's cultural history.
I always dreamed of bringing Red Sauce back to Regent Street. The park in Regent Street used to be known as Spaghetti Corners.
He now owns Fabiola's Spaghetti House and Deli, as well as Leopold's Book Bar and Cafe. Fabiola's is an ode to the businesses that made up Spaghetti Corners.
You had Josie's, you had Amato's, you had Pino's, DeSalvo's. So I wanted to create a space that had a feeling of historic significance.
But Brown's roots in the Madison culinary scene and another type of red sauce run deep. Before Fabiola's, the building was occupied by Rocky Rococo's, a pizza chain and Madison staple co-founded by his father in the 70s.
When I was 16, I was working here in high school at this Rocky's on Regent Street, doing football prep and boiling brats for game days.
He's always had big dreams for Regent Street.
I have a ridiculous love affair with Regent Street. I think that Regent Street should be a phenomenal thoroughfare that welcomes you in from the west side into the downtown.
But Leopold's and Fabiola's aren't the only way he's spicing up the neighborhood. Brown recently purchased a beloved staple, the Greenbush Bar, which is in the basement of the Italian Workmen's Club.
The Italian Workmen's Club is one of the oldest Italian social clubs in America. The building was built in 1922 by club members, and the basement space has always been a tavern.
And in July 2024, the building was added to the National Register of Historic Places. As for the bar and pizza joint inside, Brown knew if it closed, it would be a huge blow to the neighborhood because of its significance. And his goal for the space is not to change it, but to preserve it.
I would be run out of town on a rail if I changed too much over at Greenbush. So our restoration of the space is really to keep it largely as it was. The pizza is staying the same. The Christmas lights that everybody loves on the ceiling, those are staying too.
He wants to continue telling the story of the neighborhood with what's left of it.
There's a home next to the Italian Workmen's Club that was from that era, and there's a fire pit in Brittingham Park. And that's all that remains. The Italian Workmen's Club is still around, and Neighborhood House as an institution is still around. But besides that, the neighborhood is gone.
While a lot of the immigrant history is gone, Brown's vision is to bring it back to Madison, one dish and one building at a time.
Maria Brunetta brought us that story on restaurant owner Sam Brown and Madison's Greenbush neighborhood. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's Wisconsin Today.
The only way that I survived is I didn't give a damn about my reputation. Never said mine, never said mine.
That's the Tyrants playing the song Attitude. The Green Bay punk rock band helped launch a thriving punk music scene in northeastern Wisconsin.
Members of the Tyrants and other punk bands are featured in a new documentary called Green Blah. It follows the story of punk rock in Green Bay from the late 70s through the 80s.
Chris Preddy was there as a member of the band A Bunch of Morons and as a creator and director of Green Blah. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Before we get into the documentary, this is a personal story for you. You were part of this scene. You were in a band, A Bunch of Morons. What is it as a young guy in Green Bay that drew you into the punk rock scene?
It came to me from a couple of different sources. I had a really good friend in grade school whose mom worked at WAPL Radio. And she would bring home promo records. And my buddy Chris and I would, you know, sit in the bedroom and just flip through these records and play whatever looked, you know, interesting. And I don't know, we just stumbled across the Ramones, we stumbled across the Clash and Black Flag, and it just sort of drew me in. There's a lot of there's kind of like an outsider aspect to this, and I wasn't really a sports guy. You know, I was kind of I like to read and I like art. I'm not good at art, but I just appreciated that sort of thing, and it was just different and unique, especially, you know, growing up in Green Bay, which is very much Rust Belt, paper mills, factory workers, Green Bay Packers, you know, so it was like a breath of fresh air, I guess.
Well, and that's something that really struck me. I mean, this is partly a documentary about the music, but it's also about people finding their people. How important was that?
Very important. It does come out in the film. There's a couple interviews I can think of where people really felt like they just found others that were willing to accept them. And, you know, right, they were sort of misfits, didn't quite fit in, and just found this like collective spirit. And, you know, you met people from just all over, you know, different parts of the city, even from smaller communities outside of Green Bay. That was the attraction. And it just really formed like a familial type bond. Some of these friends that I met at the first punk show that I went to back in June of 1983, and I'm friends with today.
A point I want to hammer home here for younger listeners is there wasn't an internet when you guys were pulling this scene together, right? Punk music was breaking right around the world, and it kind of trickled in weird, random ways. Like you said, somebody's mom worked at a radio station and had these demos and whatever. How did people absorb this and pull it all together in this pre-internet age?
An important factor for Green Bay was we had a college radio station. It was WGBW, and it was out of the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. And there were DJs that, you know, you could play pretty much whatever to your heart's content. I mean, you brought in your own records or, you know, they had promos there and so forth. But that was one source of getting information. I would go down to, there was a place called Boss's. It was Boss's bookstore. And they had like a slew of different magazines and stuff from all over. So like Cream Magazine was a big one. You know, you could page through there and there was punk rock in there. So, you know, he found it where he could. Fanzines were important. There was a particular one in Green Bay called Sick Teen. A friend of ours, Norb Rozek, who I went to high school with, and that's where I first encountered it, was in geometry class. Norb was in a band with this guy, Perry. Perry and I sat in geometry alphabetically. And one day he just noticed that I was into a different kind of music, and he handed me this copy of Sick Teen. And I was just like, astonished. I had no idea what to make of it. I'm like, wow, another kid at this high school puts this together.
I want to check out one of the bands from kind of the first wave, as you describe it, of the Green Bay punk scene. And we'll give a listen here. This is a band called The Miners, and this song is Waves Have Hit. So, Chris, the Miners were one of a couple early bands that set the stage, literally, in some ways, for the punk scene in Green Bay. Talk a little bit about the Miners.
They were like the first wave of Green Bay punk rock, and they did shows largely at a place called Bernie's Game Room, which was on the west side across from West High School. And then they played like Night Moves. It was like a teen disco. They played Brown County Fair, but anyway, they were very influenced by, you know, that early like Clash, Sex Pistols, The Damned, that UK sort of thing, Ramones from the US, that sort of stuff. And they were sort of the precursor to the scene that I grew up in, which was kind of later in the 80s. So they were around like 79, 80, 81. And they were from like the west side of Green Bay. They put out a 45, which had two songs on it, which one we just played. And then the other band, The Tyrants, also put out a 45 with two songs. They recorded those records down in Ripon, Wisconsin. And those were really the first two punk records to come out of Green Bay, Wisconsin. So very much trailblazing.
We're talking about a new documentary called Green Blah about Green Bay's early punk scene. Chris Preddy is a co-creator and director of the film. Now, there were some downsides, in large part the reaction the punks in the scene got. Some of the film focuses on the response in Green Bay to people dressing differently, listening to different music. I want to give a listen to one of the scene members describing their experience.
I know why I left. Getting my ass kicked was just, I was done. You know, I got home, cut my rat tail off. This is not worth it. It just kind of got out of that scene. But I, at this point in my life, I look back and it really hurts because I don't know why I walked away from those friends, you know?
Can you talk some about that negative response from, people in the community, in your age group in particular?
Yeah, that was very real. It's so much different these days because I've made comments amongst people I know today where, you know, you might see somebody with pink hair or green hair and it's like pretty commonplace. But for Green Bay and I mean, Wisconsin, I think in general, and I mean, even bigger cities, Chicago, it's like if you were in 1983 and you were outside the norm, it was not very well received. Sometimes you would get into fights or, and it was really for, I would say, looks that weren't that extreme. You know, I mean, you know, you can always picture punks, like if you think England, you know, Mohawks and whatever. But I mean, in Green Bay, it was short hair and, you know, wearing a pair of Chuck Taylors and riding a skateboard. Yeah.
You looked like a bunch of Wisconsin kids to me.
Yeah, right. It wasn't really. Yeah, I remember I was skateboarding home from my high school and, you know, four kids pulled up in a car and started giving you grief. And it's like, okay, really? I mean, not really that extreme. But yeah, you really did come across that in high school. You know, people would say things or maybe spit on you. But eventually, you know, I mean, like you said, a punk sort of became mainstream later on. And now it's just pretty widely accepted, I would say, overall. But I think in this day and age, people don't sort of realize that at the time it was happening, it was, you kind of had to really live with consequences, I guess. You know what I mean?
On a more positive note, something that struck me, of course, the heroes of the documentary are the, you know, the bands and the organizers and the fans and things like that. Lurking at the margins are older people, some of them who would say, yes, yes, you can practice in our basement, even though I don't know what this noise is that you're making. Or, yeah, I have a recording studio. I don't know what you kids are playing, but sure, I'll record you. Kind of inspiring as someone now in an older generation, like saying yes to the kids, even if you don't get what the heck they're doing.
Yeah, that was a big part of it. And one of the venues that we had in Green Bay that's in the latter part of the film is Kutzka's Hall. Yeah. Bob Kutzka, who ran Kutzka's Hall, bar side of the hall, or there was the bar, and then there was the dance hall. And the punk shows would be happening in the dance hall, but then like Bob and his regulars would be hanging out in the bar. And, you know, some of the older punk guys would go in there as well. But that was Bob's feeling on it was, you know, that these kids weren't really accepted elsewhere in the city. And, you know, we were trying to behave. We had these shows and they weren't as terrible as everybody would expect. And, you know, we had a lot of respect for Bob for, you know, having that openness and the willingness to have those shows there. And we had shows there for, I mean, like 4 or 5 years.
Chris, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
That's Chris Preddy, co-creator of Green Blah, a new film about Green Bay's early punk scene in the 1970s into the 80s. You can see it at the Tarleton Theater. That's coming up on December 21st. This is more from the city's early punk rock scene. It's the band Depo Provera. The band, the song is called Brainwash.
Tis the season for cookie walks in communities all over the state, and we want to give a shout out to St. Peter's 26th annual Country Christmas Cookie Walk in Lebanon this weekend, and the generations of bakers there who volunteer to make tens of thousands of cookies. They officially started the mixing at the beginning of November.
Are you involved in a cookie walk in your community? What kind of cookie do you contribute? How do you decorate them? Or is there a cookie walk that you enjoy going to, or you can gather a wide selection of homemade treats?
Leave us a message or text us now about your cookie pursuits. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Or email Wisconsin Today at WPR.org. Only one word, Rob, comes to mind for these cookie walks, and that is yum.
I think they need to embed me as a reporter for the whole scene. To sample the dough, sample the final product. I'm there. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.